Welcome once again to the Best Tankers Talks podcast. This is actually the first time that it's been recorded on video. So our guest today is going to be a pioneer in this kind of format. Today I have the pleasure of talking to Francois Rochon, founder of Giverny Capital. This is a very special episode for me because, as many of the listeners already know, I am an admirer of Francois's investment style and ability to swim against the current. I imagine most of the listeners will also know you, Francois, but let me talk briefly about your achievements. So Giverny Capital was actually founded in 1998 and registered in the year 2000. And the fund has a track record of outperforming the benchmark. You can go for more details to Giverny's webpage. So yeah, welcome Francois, and thank you very much for taking the time. I imagine you have a pretty busy schedule, more so during earnings season and especially at the beginning of a new year.
Well, it's really, these days it's writing the annual letter that takes most of my time. It usually takes about 2 months, so I don't do it full time, but I put a lot of effort to make it interesting. So, but you know, we're long-term investors. So earnings season, yeah, we look at the results, but it's not that important, the short-term results of our companies.
Good. I think many people are anxiously waiting for the 2022 annual letter. So I think many people listening to this are trying to build maybe a professional career in the investment industry. And maybe would like to know your career path before founding Giverny. So let's start there. What did you do before founding Giverny?
Well, I was very interested in stocks and the stock market from a very young age, but the stereotyped image I had, it was a big casino dominated by financial sharks. So it was not something, although I was interested, was not something I thought was a serious career path. So I was interested in mathematics and physics and, you know, understanding how the world works. So engineering made a lot of sense to me. So I started to study engineering at the Polytechnical School in Montreal. I got my degree and then did a master's degree. And then started to work as an engineer. Mostly I did the first years, I was a research assistant. So, and, you know, when I started to have some savings to invest, I started to invest in the stock market. And I wanted to learn everything about investing. So I took some course, I read some books, accounting books. So I would probably for a year, I read everything I could on the investing, stock market, and accounting. And one day, someone talked to me about Peter Lynch. So I bought his book, One Up on Wall Street, and it was really like seeing the light. So it was not a casino, the stock market. When you bought shares, you become a shareholder in a company. So my view of the stock market totally changed, and Peter Lynch, presented the idea of value investing, buying a company for less than what it's worth. And in that book, he also talks about Warren Buffett. So the next step was to read about Buffett. So I sent him a letter to Omaha because that was before the internet. And he sent me a big package of old annual reports. And I read everything. I think it went from 1977 to 1992. So, I read everything, and, you know, I read The Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham. I read Philip Fisher's book, and, you know, I found that so interesting. And the approach of Mr. Buffett of finding great companies and buying them below their intrinsic value and holding them many, many years, and companies with competitive advantage, he uses the word moat, or franchise value in the first years, really struck a chord with me. I thought it made a lot of sense, and I wanted to use that approach. So I started to manage my own capital. And after, you know, 3 or 4 years of having good results, I decided that, this new career was for me. So I left engineering in 96 and went to work for a portfolio management firm. But I quickly learned that institutional investment firms sometimes have shorter time horizon than I did. And so after 2 years of, working at a few firms, I decided that for me, the best thing was to start my own investment firm and really apply the long-term investment approach based on the Warren Buffett's investment philosophy. So that's when I started Giverny Capital. And the approach was very simple. I would buy for the clients. I would find the same security. So I would clone my portfolio to their portfolio. And really, that's how it started.
So I think a bit linked to this question, something that always makes me curious is how an investor's style develops until reaching a point where maybe it only needs some minor tweaks. So I think that by reading your annual letters, one can infer that Giverny was born with a somewhat established investment style. But how did your... I know that you started, you just told that you started with Peter Lynch, then Warren Buffett, but did your investment style evolve through the years until what the investor you are today?
Well, I would say the basic investment philosophy evolved very quickly. I would say I probably started by trying to find unknown companies that were very cheap and did okay with that approach. So it was probably a little more like Ben Graham approach. And I wouldn't even say years, it's probably months, because pretty quickly, by reading Warren Buffett letters, by reading also Philip Fisher's book, I realized pretty quickly that the best thing was to find great companies and perhaps pay a little higher P ratio than a typical value investor would be ready to pay for and hold them many, many years. So probably already in 93. So I had that approach, and when I started to the portfolio and to measure the return and everything, I think the investment philosophy was already the same as it is today. Now, I like to think it has improved with experience and all the mistakes I've made over the years. So I think I've learned a little bit and I've improved on the process of finding those investments. But the basic investment philosophy, I think, has not really changed since 93.
Okay, so you mentioned there that you invest in quality companies that sometimes trade at maybe higher multiples that any value investor would maybe bother looking at. I know this might be a difficult question, but there are many moving parts, but how would you define a quality company in one or two short sentences? You can take 3 or 4 sentences if you want.
Well, I think one very good indication is a company that has high return on equity for many years without leverages. So I think your leverage can sometimes distort the calculation of return on equity. So it's really looking at companies that can earn, I would say, good return on capital, and it can be sustained for many, many years. So it's not a year or two or at the top of the cycle, I think that it's sustainable for many years. And there's a reason behind superior returns. You can find some kind of competitive advantage within the nature of the company or its culture. Either it can be a brand or a first entry to a technology service that makes them very special and unique. But basically, they have a competitive advantage. That's probably the main characteristic of a quality company. Of course, there's a reason behind a competitive advantage. Usually, it's great people, great managers that either have built the company in the past and built those intrinsic competitive advantage, or they are still managed by great people and they are improving year after year the depth of the moat of the company. So I would say it's really a competitive advantage. Yet it's probably reflected in the high return on capital, but the source of those great returns. It's really a kind of competitive advantage.
Yeah, and I guess many people, when looking at analyzing quality companies, they tend to think that it's actually like that the numbers back it all up. But there's obviously a lot of there's a lot of things that are subjective, because it also depends on the durability of this competitive advantage. So what would you say is the things that you focus on the most and the things you focus on the least? I guess that, you already said that the people are very important, so maybe that's going to be at the top. But around management, I would like to know, how do you look at management's ownership and compensation? Because I know that a lot of investors put a lot of weight here, but others don't care as much, as long as the manager has, for example, a track record of excellent execution.
It's not easy, because there's not one simple answer. It's really, every human being is different. So you have to judge them on kind of one-by-one situation. Yes, of course, the ideal situation would be, an example of that would be probably Fastenal 30 years ago. Fastenal 30 years ago was managed by Robert Kurling. He was a CEO and founder. He owned, I don't remember, 25% of the shares. He was paid $100,000 a year, and he had no stock options. So that was the ideal situation. He was a great entrepreneur, a great culture. They were very low cost. He owned a big chunk of the company. He didn't have stock options. His salary was very modest. So that's the ideal situation. The non-ideal situation is when manager is paid a lot of money, doesn't have a big stake, and he's not necessarily rewarded exactly in line with how the shareholders are rewarded. He can be rewarded without really the shareholders getting superior returns. So beside those two extremes, there's a lot of situation. But ideally, you want CEO that have a good percentage of the business. But I've seen some cases when the managers didn't have a lot of shares in the company, but did an incredible job over many years. So I don't think it's really to see what's the plan, how he manages the business. Does he have a long-term horizon? And probably the one great quality that is needed for a CEO is capital allocation. So if you're going to own a company for 10 years, a big part of your return will be linked on how yearly profits were reinvested. Did they make acquisition? Did they buy that stock? Did they give dividends? Did they develop new products? So capital allocation is very important. It has to make sense in terms of building a culture and increasing the moat of the business, compared to their competitors.
And I want to circle back a bit on the topic of
phrases, was it?
Sorry,
that was not two or three phrases. Sorry about
that. No, but that's fine. I want to briefly touch on the topic of, again, competitive advantages. But we know that there are many types of competitive advantages. Like, some companies would have a competitive advantage that is protected, but maybe a high capital intensity, while others, and this has been especially true in the last years, have maybe a moat that is protected by technology or maybe the network effects. So do you have kind of a categorization of competitive advantages? I know it's probably on a case like the question before, it's on a case to case scenario, but do you think that, like, do you favor some competitive advantages over others? Because I know that there are investors that will look more at, for example, capital-intensive businesses and will avoid completely investing in tech stocks because they think that it's not a real moat. So, what are your thoughts on that?
I would start by what I would avoid, and if you sell a commodity, oil or some kind of metal, zinc or steel or copper, I think it's very hard to develop a competitive advantage. There are some exceptions, of course. I mean, Nucor was a great company for many, many, many years. So even in a very tough industry like the steel industry, they managed to do very well. So it's really a case by case. And you talk about technology. There are some companies like Microsoft or Amazon or Google that do have an incredible moat, in our opinion. Of course, if you look at history, there are very few technology companies that have been able to be leaders and sustain their competitive advantage over decades. It's tough because it changes so rapidly. If you miss a turn somewhere, you can be cast out of the market very rapidly. So, and you know, there's many companies that I purchased 25 years ago, 24 years ago, and they don't exist anymore. So I've learned from that. So it's tougher probably in the technology industries because it changed so much. Doesn't mean that you can't find a great company in those sectors with some competitive advantage. And, you know, Microsoft is probably one of the great enterprises of all time. So it can't certainly be possible. And it's been great for many years, many decades. So it's really a case by case. But, you know, when you study the history of American corporations, the life expectancy is not that high. A lot of companies will disappear after a few decades, and some that used to be, you know, great, great companies. I mean, Kodak or Xerox, the company still exists, but, you know, it's not as dominant as it was many years ago. IBM or Sears, for instance. So it's very hard to keep on being dominant and having this moat. The moat for any company is always shrinking or expanding, always. So you have to always be open to follow what's happening to company and try to find those that the moat is increasing and perhaps avoid those that the moat is decreasing. I mean, the retail industry has been very hard to find their permanent winners. I mean, there are some. One example, I think, is TGX. I've been in this niche of selling clothes at very good prices, but that's one exception because the general experience of many retailers has been very, very tough.
I think you bring up a great point in that a moat is dynamic. So even when it feels like super safe, it's actually going one way or another, and an investor must assess where it's going. So after finding a high quality company, then you must like decide how you build your position in case the valuation is appropriate, of course, and how much you allocate to it. So how much do you have a process to decide how much a position will weigh or how you will build your position? And do you have any hard rules, so to say? So for example, I will never let a position be more than 15% of the entire portfolio or something like that.
Yeah. Probably in my younger years, I was more confident in my decision. So probably I could start with 4, 5, or 6% in the company very rapidly. Today, I've seen my shares of disappointments. So I'm much more prudent. I usually start with 1 or 2% with a new investment. And as I get more confidence in my decision, I will increase it. And the goal is to have something like 20 to 25 names with an average weight of about 4%. So if everything goes well in investment, it will become something like a 4% weight. And we have the attitude of letting our winners run. So as a company does well, it will become a bigger part of the portfolio. And once it reaches 10%, we'll trim it. We don't want any position to be more than 10%. In the first years, probably there were some securities that went up to 15 or 20%. I think that probably the highest was 20%. But like I said, with experience come a little more realism. And it's very hard to find a company that, you know, there's absolutely... there are some that the risk is very low. But to me, And it depends from one person to the other. To me, having a 4 or 5% weight on average for an investment and having a maximum of 10%, I'm comfortable that I'm managing the risk properly. But, you know, I have friends that are very smart and very bright that have, you know, nine stocks in their portfolio. So the average holding is 11, 12%. So, and they're doing well also. It's just different ways of seeing things. And I have my own personal way of looking at it. And I think 20 to 25 names is kind of a good balance between having sufficient diversification so you reduce the risk of, you know, one or two mistakes. And also at the same time, it's focused enough, it's concentrated enough so that you have odds of beating the index. Because once you go to 50 or 60 names, I think it's very hard to beat the index. The odds become very low.
Yeah, and I think also if you have 20 to 25 positions, you can actually follow the portfolio maybe closely like you would like. Because if you see, I don't know, many portfolios of 100, 150 companies, like for me, obviously, I don't have the resources of a large fund. But for an individual investor, that would be very, very hard to keep up with. Maybe you have, well, even a portfolio with 150 positions can be concentrated because you can have a lot of weight in some positions and then some very small positions. So you don't have to follow them as closely. So I think something that's very common, I'm going to talk like about a theme that it's more of what we're seeing today, is a lot of investors are trying to jump from one factor of or one sector to another, trying to catch the upswings and trying to leave the to avoid the downswings. I think this is very common, obviously, when stocks are going down, because everyone wants to be in the safe part of the market. I know Giverny doesn't follow this strategy, but when I look at your positions, I do see that you have, like, the portfolio is very diversified across industries. So how do you think about the circle of competence? Are you always trying to expand it, or are you comfortable with the industries you know by now and you're trying to fish in those industries?
It's really case by case again. It's really... we don't really focus on industries. We focus on companies and trying to find companies that we believe have something special. And yeah, I think we own 4 bank stocks in the portfolio. Sometimes it was lower than that. Probably 4 is the highest we've had. I'm not a fan of the banking industry. I think it's very competitive and very hard to have some kind of edge compared to the others. I do believe, though, that they are great bankers. So I always say when we invest in bank, what we really are doing is investing in a banker. So the CEO is very important. I think the culture that he is installing in the bank is very important. And we want a culture that is very based on conservatism. So most banks that fail, it's because they made bad loans. So they weren't disciplined enough to make loans, you know, that make economic sense. So we want bankers and the culture that they've installed in the bank that are very prudent and conservative. And I think the 4 banks we own are in those kind of banks. But it's not because we love the banking sector. It's the same thing with the insurance industry. We've got Markel, Berkshire Hathaway, of course, and Progressive. I'm not a fan of the insurance industry. I think it's a very competitive industry. It's very hard to sustain for many years high return on capital. But I think those 3 are very disciplined. They focus on some niche. I think Progressive is probably the best car insurance in the U.S. And they've been gaining share for, you know, 50 years, I don't know. More so since they started selling insurance on the internet in 99. So, and, you know, I owned the Progressive, I think, from 99 to 2005, and then followed it from far for 14 years and bought it back again in 2019. So there were some periods that I think were all tougher for Progressive, but with the proliferation of telematics, and they're more able to price the insurance for their clients. I think the last few years have been good, and the next few years should also be good. But it's not a decision to invest in the insurance industry. It's really because we found companies that we believe have some kind of competitive advantage in the industry. So, and you know, we own NVR, which is a company that builds houses. Again, this is a very cyclical industry. It's a little better now, but for many years it was a very capital intensive industry. But NVR found kind of a niche where they didn't own a lot of assets. They were very light asset balance sheet, and they had options on land. So, and they were really focused on being very effective in building houses. And you know, I've been following it for, I don't know, 20 years, and I think it's very well managed. It's of course a little cyclical, but probably less than the other companies in the industry. So it's not, I'm not a fan of the housing industry in general, but I think this company has some kind of niche and competitive moat. So it's really the same thing we do for all the sectors.
Yeah, I think there was a paper by Mabusan that he talked about the return on invested capital. And obviously you could see that there were industries that were good on average. Like there were a lot of companies doing well, but there were always, in even in bad industries, there were always good companies. So that's like, I think summarizes what you said here, that obviously you can, it might not be the best industry, but you can find a player that is outperforming their peers or is better than others. So you're not going to say no to an industry just because the industry is maybe doesn't have the best economics.
I started to invest probably at that time, the best industry in the US was the drug industry. I mean, you looked at Pfizer and Merck and J&J, and there was some churn clock. They were all great businesses. But at some point, it became tougher. And if you look at the last, you know, 10, 15 years, the growth has not been as strong as it was probably in the 80s and early 90s. So sometimes an industry can be very good for a while, but after a few changes in the environment, it's not as good. So, and you know, if you take the rail industry, the railway industry, for so many decades, it was a very tough industry, very capital intensive, lots of costs, and it was very hard to earn a high return on equity. But, you know, some changes happened at the end of the 90s and early 2000s. And when we bought shares in Burlington Northern Santa Fe, it was probably 2007, I think. It was a fantastic business, and Berkshire bought it in 2009 or 10. And they've done very well with it. And we owned after a while, I think in 2012, we bought Union Pacific and owned it for 7 or 8 years. And it's been a good investment also. But for so many years, the railway industry was not a very good industry to invest in. I don't think they had lots of moat, but they at some point they were able to build a moat. And today it's either CN or Union Pacific. They are great businesses.
And I think you talked about the pharma in the drug industry. I don't know if I'm correct here, but I think one of the mistakes you cite in one of your annual letters is actually a drug company, that it's Valeant, I think. So I want to talk a bit about, because mistakes are sort of taboo in investing. You know, like you see a lot of people laughing about the mistakes of others as if they themselves didn't make mistakes, which is obviously not true, because everyone makes mistakes while investing. So obviously there's nothing wrong with this. And I think it says a lot about a person being able to be transparent about the mistakes, and you even give them medals in your annual letters. So through these decades managing Giverny, what would you say was by far your largest mistake, and what did you learn from it?
Well, it was not Valeant, but Valeant was a big mistake. And although I'm a little ashamed. I can't talk about it a little bit. We were lucky with Valiant because I think overall we probably doubled our money over 4 or 5 years. But that was that. That was luck because that was a big mistake. And the reason we invested in 2011 is that, like I said, I knew that the drug industry was not as profitable as it used to be. And one reason was that a lot of billions of dollars were spent on R&D that didn't yield good results. So Mike Pearson came up with this plan of reducing costs, reducing R&D, so acquiring companies that didn't have necessarily a patent, but had a drug that had revenues, and just reducing costs and improving the profitability of those companies. And part of it was also to increase the price of the drug. So he did that for a few years and had good results. It didn't really fit all that well into our investment philosophy because the accounting was a little aggressive and also they had a little bit of debt on the balance sheet. But they were some great acquisition. Probably the best one was the Butch & Lom. It's still a great business. And I remember we had some other money manager's friend that owned Valiant, and one of them used the phrase that Mike Pearson was a value investor in the drug industry. That's really how we saw Mike Pearson and his plan. And like I said, for a while, he did very well, but the last acquisition that he did didn't turn out very well. And he had put a lot of debt on the balance sheet, so things turned sour. And very quickly, when we realized that, we sold all our shares. And I knew that the risk in Valiant was a little higher than the other investment in the portfolio. So what I decided to compensate for that higher risk was to cap that investment, not at 10%, but at 5% in terms of market value in the portfolio. So when the stock did very well in the first years, we trimmed it every time it went beyond 5%. So we were lucky in the end because I think we trimmed it twice. And also we sold it as soon as we thought that the situation was a little serious. So in the end, we did, I think, overall, from the start to the end, probably double our money. But it was a big, big mistake. And the mistake was really in the judgment of the quality of CEO of Mike Pearson. I think it was just too aggressive that it turned out that things went very bad. So that was a mistake, but it's not the worst mistakes. The real big mistakes is when you find a company that really fits your criteria and you don't buy it for some simplistic reason, like it's a little too pricey. And, you know, the stock increases 1,000% over 10 years or 2,000% over 15 years. And you don't see the costs and the statements, but you know, when you miss a 2,000% investment because of some stupid reason, that's much bigger error than the stock that you buy that you lose 50%. So if you look at the medals, you know, I think I've been giving medals to mistakes for the last 20 years. So we're probably talking about 60 medals over the years. Probably of the 60, there's 55 that are omissions, so error of omissions, not commissions. The big mistakes are sure. And, you know, there are so many, I wouldn't know where to start, but, you know, one that comes to my mind is Copart. I think it's a fantastic company. I knew the company. I read the book that the founder wrote. It's a fantastic business. I mean, Starbucks, I looked at it in 1994. Can you imagine? Probably I would have made 50 times my money. And I mean, Microsoft, we used to own it and we sold it just before thing really improved, 2016 or 17. And, you know, it goes on and on. I mean, LVMH that owns Louis Vuitton, I look at that, I think 11 years ago during the European crisis in 2011. And it was trading at 15 times earnings. And I thought, it's a little too expensive. And it's probably one of the best business in the world. And it's up 500% since then. So These are the big mistakes. Companies that do fit your criteria, and for some reason that are usually linked to not paying perhaps the appropriate price, you miss it. And these are huge costs.
I was actually going to ask you what you just said with Valiant, because I think many people equate like a mistake with losing money, or maybe not making money. But I think there's actually quite a fair bit of mistakes that many investors can make, and they're actually making money on the investment, but they thought maybe this company is going to appreciate for reason X, and then they look back in 5 years and the company actually appreciated, but it was due to reason Y. So they don't take it as a mistake, but it's actually not one of outcome, but maybe one of process. And I think I was actually going to ask you this next, but you just described it perfectly with Valiant, which it was a situation where you made money, but you actually made a mistake, and you were, you didn't have like the ego to not cut the investment just because you were making money and you were able to cut it.
You know, if you take the example of Visa, that's been a portfolio for 12 years, I bought it in 2010. I always say I was lucky with Visa because I was stupid, but I was lucky in my stupidity. I looked at Visa, probably the stock was, I don't exactly remember the numbers, but let's say $30 in 2010, and it was, I don't know, 20 times earnings. And there was some political pressure to reduce the interchange fees, and the stock went down to $20. So it went down 35%. And I was lucky. I had my opportunity, and I bought it. And we did well, and today their stock is, I don't know, 200 and 250. So we made probably 10 times our money. Sadly, we trimmed it a few times, so we didn't have the full 1,000% result that we should have, but we still did very well. But the mistake was, I was lucky that the stock went to 20, because if it had not corrected to 20 and it stayed at 30 in 2010, probably I would never have bought it. And it would have been a big mistake, because even if you bought it at 30 before it went down 30%, you still would have made 6 or 7 times your money instead of 10 times. But, you know, make 6 or 7 times your investment over a 12-year period, still a very good return. And, you know, it's a great company, Visa. So the intrinsic risk was very, very low. It seemed pricey at that time, but it was not that pricey. Mm-hmm. So I did a mistake of not buying at 30, but I was lucky enough to buy at 20. So you don't see that mistake in the statement, but
yeah.
Mistake if the stock has not corrected back then.
So I think linked to this, one of the very important things for an investor is probably the psychology or the mentality. So the emotional coefficient, not the intellectual coefficient. And I think one of my favorite annual letters is one where you talk about something called the tribal gene and how not having it or succumbing to it has potential benefits for long-term investors. So first, can you explain for people that don't know what the tribal gene is? And then I'm going to ask you a very direct question. Do you think that a long-term investor can't be born, like can only be born and cannot be made?
Well, that's a very interesting question. So I'll start by the first one. Yes, a tribal gene theory that came up, and it's a theory, as I have not proved it. And since I have a scientific background, I understand the difference between theory, hypothesis, and, you know, facts and, you know, conclusion that makes scientific sense. So it doesn't make scientific sense. So I want to say that up front. But it's kind of observations. And my observation is most human beings that have a normal DNA sequence have this gene which I've called the tribal gene. So when the tribe runs, you know, they have the instinct of running with the tribe. And because there's probably a good reason for the tribe to be running. I mean, probably 25,000 years ago, you were in a little village and a big tiger would come up and everyone would start to run while the thing to do was to run. So this gene was passed over many thousands of years of evolution. And it's just how the human being is programmed. But for some reasons, it's probably a defect. 5% of the population doesn't seem to have that gene. They can go one way when the tribe is going the opposite way. And they can think for themselves. They can think in new ways. These are usually the creators, the artists, the writers, and I think also the ones that build companies, the entrepreneur. So they're able to think differently. They're able to find value in something that the others don't see, and they are able to think for themselves. So when everyone wants to buy tech stocks or Bitcoin, they're able to think by themselves and say, well, I don't think it makes sense. And it's very hard, like you say, to fight a gene, because, you know, people will rationalize it, but at the end, they just respond to natural impulses. And you're right, I do believe that to be able to have better than the average return on the stock market, I think you need to have the missing tribal gene, tribal gene. If you have it, I think it's very hard to be the index. If you don't have it, I think it's possible. So I would say you're right. I would say that it cannot be really, it can be thought in some way, but, you know, if you're part of the normal 95% of the population, I think it's almost impossible over many, many years, of course, to do better than the average, because you're not able to go one way when all the others are going the other way. And I mean, the crowd following attitude of most investors is sometimes surprising. Mm-hmm. And not to follow the crowd is an exception. It's not the rule. Just yep. How human natures are. So to answer the question, yes, I do think that to be the index over many years, I think you have to be in that 5% that don't have the tribal gene.
And that actually, I don't know if you've seen Charlie Munger's interview yesterday, but he actually said that only 5% of the people that were there in the interview would beat the index. So that's like a perfect match between the 5% that doesn't have the tribal gene. I don't know if it was in one of your annual letters or you read it somewhere else.
It was in my annual letter, but I think William Green talked about it in his latest book. So it was published by other authors. But
and I don't know if you also mentioned that if, for example, I don't know if I read this in your annual letter, but if, for example, if a person likes fast cars or adrenaline, then it's difficult for that person to be a long-term investor, because they will always be looking for the rush or the adrenaline. And obviously long-term investing I don't feel it's boring, because I think long-term investing is not boring if you love analyzing businesses. But if what you like is looking at stock prices and making money fast, then obviously long-term investing is very boring. I don't know if it was in one of your annual letters, but...
No, it wasn't, but I'll trust you that it does make sense. Well, I'm not a fast car person.
And now on continuing a bit on this topic of investor psychology, I want to touch a bit on the topic of the past, because, I mean, you see many investors trying to search for the next Amazon or the next Apple or the next Constellation Software or whatever. Maybe on fears that, maybe because they've studied the history of capitalism, that these companies are closer to the end because they have lived for longer. So they are just trying to find for maybe that same company, but 15 years ago. But I want to talk about the concept of the Lindy effect, that states that when a company has lived for many years, then the probability of that company surviving for an equal number of years is larger than, for example, I'm going to put a simple example. So the Lindy effect basically states that on average, an 80-year-old company has more probability of surviving an additional 80 years than maybe a 10-year-old company has of surviving the next 10. So what are your thoughts on the Lindy effect? And do you focus on the past when analyzing a company? Because I feel like many people just underwrite the past, like this has happened, it doesn't matter, investing should be about the future. But I actually feel, I personally weigh a lot the past in some of when I'm analyzing a company, not only because I feel it's important to understand how a company has built itself, because it can always show you important things of how maybe a company has survived a past recession, what the management did.
Yes, of course you're right on one thing. When you buy shares, you're really buying the future. It's the future results that's going to reward you. Past results only reward past shareholders. So when you buy a company, what you're really buying is future cash flows that can be discounted to today's price. That said, I think Warren Buffett had a perfect phrase to sum it up. He said it many years ago, but I remember it was an annual meeting, I think. He said, if a company has a great future but a lousy past, we'll miss it. So I would say that's really what also we're trying to do. We're trying to first find company that has a great past and a great present. I mean, they have good return on capital. They've rewarded shareholders in the past. They have a competitive advantage, a great balance sheet. And we believe that everything is in place for continuation in the future of those great results. But if the company has a lousy past, or is it's a very young company that doesn't really have much past, I think it's very hard to have an idea of what the future looks like. You'll probably take risk, and sometimes it will work out, sometimes it won't work out. The danger is to find a company that does have a great future, but it's already priced in the level of the stock market today. So if you buy a great company that trades at, I don't know, 100 times earnings, and you know, earnings increase by sixfold in the next decade, but the P ratio falls to 20 times, you know, didn't really have a good return, because so much of the future that was great in the end was already discounted in the price. So you have to be very careful when you're buying the future.
Well, I'm going to take this example because I think it's perfect for the next question. Maybe not at the extreme of 100 times earnings, but there's a common belief that high-quality companies are always fully valued. But then you can see that they keep outperforming the market despite these fears. I mean, I think that they always trade at optically expensive P ratios, especially if you're anchored to a P ratio. I don't know, if you say, I'm not going to buy anything above 10 times earnings, then obviously these companies are going to appear to be very overvalued. But then these companies kind of continue to prove that they were not fully valued by the market. So what do you think the market is missing in valuing high quality companies? Is it something of the quality of the business itself, maybe the durability?
Well, if you study the last 50 years, there have been periods when great growth companies were very popular and trading at very high P ratio. I wasn't around, really. I was alive, but I wasn't investing. In 1972, you had the Nifty 50 that traded at very high P ratio, 40, 50, 60 times earnings. And, you know, in 73, 74, they went down a lot. So in the end, they were great growth companies, not all of them, but most of them did very well in terms of intrinsic growth and their value. But they were so pricey that they didn't do that well for an investment. And I do remember probably at the end of the 90s, probably 97, 98, I think General Electric traded at 30 times earnings. Coke at some point was 40, 50 times earnings. And General Electric turned out that didn't do very well. But Coke did continue to grow at good ratios, not 15% per year, but 6, 7, 8% a year. But the P ratio today is probably 24, 25 times. So There was a big reduction, the P ratio in the last 25 years for coke. And a lot of companies, if you look at Cisco System, for instance, because I know the company well, we purchased it in 97, I think, and I ran it for 2 years, and it did well. But if you look at the peak of 2000, I think the stock traded at $80 per share, and the earnings per share were 65, 70 cents per share. So the P ratio was more than 100. And if you look at the stock today, I think it's $52. And last year they earned, I don't remember exactly, but let's say $3.50. So earnings did grow something like 8 or 9% a year in the last 22 years. But the stock is lower today than it was at the peak of 2000. So that's a very long time, 22 years for not making money. So I think even the greatest company, the intrinsic value is not infinite. You need the margin of safety. Ben Graham was, when he wrote The Intelligent Investor, the conclusion, the last chapter is that if you had to sum up intelligent investing in one phrase, was margin of safety. I still think 70 years later, that's still the right three words, margin of safety. Yes, we want to own great quality companies, but you need a margin of safety and the P ratio that you pay for them. Is it 15 times, 20, 25, up to 30? I don't know the exact number, but I think you always need a margin of safety. And in the example of Cisco or Coke in 98, I think the margin of safety was very low and the results were probably disappointing for many investors. And of course, it exists today on many growth stock. I do believe that. And some will do okay because valuation is more reasonable, and some will do poorly because valuation is way too high.
Mm-hmm. So staying in this topic of valuation, I think it's a very complex topic because you need to discount the future, but the future is very complex to model, so to say, because there are a lot of uncertainties or maybe events that are impossible to foresee. How do you...
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Future is unknown. Really.
Yeah. So how do you go
about... have a general assessment and have a view, and you can believe that you understand the company and that, you know, the future looks great and you can be right. You have to accept that the future is unknown. What you want to do is find companies that you believe the odds are higher than average, that you can have a good assessment of what the future will look like.
Do you build, so to say, complex valuation models, or do you take more of the simple route where you project maybe an EPS or the earnings power of the company, I don't know how many years out, and then you slap a multiple on that, or how do you go about valuation? Because it's a lot
exactly
of people weigh differently.
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. We try to usually we go 5 years in the future and try to have a model for the next 5 years. We come up with an estimation of what the earnings per share will be in 5 years and apply a P ratio that we believe is justified. And it's hard, of course, because it will depend on how the prospects look in 5 years. But we try to come up with a reasonable, objective, realistic number. And you multiply the P ratio you've decided that makes sense to the earnings per share estimates, and you get a 5-year target. Ideally, we want to buy today at half what we think it's going to be worth in 5 years. So if we're right, we would earn 50% annually in that investment. That's what we're trying to do. We realize that there's a lot of uncertainties, but like I said, we try to favor the one that we're more confident that will be racked on the earnings assessment and also the P ratio that we believe makes sense.
And of course, there will be investment that will be wrong, but there's also uncertainties to the upside, so to say. So maybe you model something that gives you 15%, but the company executes much better, so it makes up for the companies that have performed worse.
Yeah, and I would say that the next step of what you just said is the key is to hold on to the ones that do well, and probably as fast as you can, you sell those that, you know, things didn't go as planned. But the big winners, the one that not only did your scenario happen, but as you said, things were even better because, you know, we're always conservative and sometimes we were too conservative and things did go well, much better than anticipated. And when that happened, usually that's the stock will do very well and look a little pricey at some point. And the trap is to sell this company that's done well and the P ratio looks a little high. And now I think you have to be reluctant to sell the investment that are doing very, very well. So you want to keep your winners and try to sell the losers as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think
you're right. When you're conservative, sometimes you'll have surprise on the upside, but that's the one you want to keep.
I think trimming and selling in general is also a bit of a personal topic, because for example, I find it very difficult to exit a position and then rebuild it. I don't know why. I think I know it's something personal. It's like zero objective. It's completely subjective, but I'm very reluctant to sell something because it's expensive, because I know that I'm going to have a trouble getting back in, maybe when it's not so expensive. That's something personal. I think staying here in the topic of selling, I think it's much more difficult than buying, obviously, because especially if you have held something for, say, 10 years and you have a nice gain on that position, I think it's you're sort of biased, so to say, to sell because you've held it, the stock has done well. And Valiant here is, again, a great example because you've made money, but you need to sell it. And I think it's kind of psychological there. So I think you already touched on this, but would you sell if the valuation gets too extreme, or even then you'll just hold to the position?
That's a tough topic because you want to hold on to your winners. You, like I said, have to perhaps accept a little higher P ratio than you'd like to, but there is a point where it doesn't make sense. And no, I talk about Cisco. No, I don't want to talk for Warren Buffett, but probably Warren Buffett should have sold his shares of Coke when they were trading at 50 times earnings. So yes, we want to own great companies, but there is a level that is just too high. It does happen. And I think when it happens, the rational thing is to sell and just invest in something else. And even though there's probably some tax consequences or anything like that, there is a level that, you know, at some point doesn't make sense. So I don't know where to start, but I've seen lots of examples of companies that got way pricey, and it stayed that expensive for many years sometimes. But usually the stock market always reflect the intrinsic value, and valuation will get back to a more normalized level at some point. So you have to accept that. And yes, of course, I think some companies, the stock is just too pricey. You have to sell it, even if it's a little painful.
Yep. So it's been a great conversation, Francois. Thank you very much for taking the time. I want to jump into the last two questions. The first one is, I think you touched a bit on this topic at the start. How does one manage to build a successful long-term oriented fund in a world that's dominated by short-term incentives? So I mean, fund managers are constantly looking for how to increase AUM. By trying to outperform every year, or like jumping from one style to another just to be in the top charts. So with now, it's obviously, I would say, it's easier because you have a track record, but in the early years, was it really tough to get up from the ground because you were sagging while the industry was sagging? What you said, you were of the 5% that was not following the crowd.
Well, when I started, you're right, it was very small when I started, and I think I was alone for the first 4 years. JP joined in 2002, it was very hard even to pay a salary at the beginning, so it took many years, but I was ready to wait. What was important to me first was doing what I love, the way I thought was intelligent. I could have been wrong, but it had to make sense to me to invest in a certain way. And I knew that it was not popular necessarily in the short term. And, you know, I started Giverny probably at the end of the tech bubble in 2000. So the first probably months of the company, it was hard to gather clients because people were making lots of money on Nortel networks and GDS Uniphase or other companies that were doing very well at that time. And it was hard to convince them that we could invest in stable company growing 12% a year. That didn't seem very sexy at that time. But, you know, I thought the approach made sense. And in the end, more than 20 years later, very slowly, the assets under management have increased. And I was ready to wait. There was no hurry. The important thing is, at that time and still today, is to invest in a way that I believe is rational and is sound. And you know, I manage money for family and members and friends and colleagues and entrepreneur friends that have entitled me with their saving. And it's very important that I be a good steward of capital. Yes, I want to have good returns, but managing risk is also very important. So when you follow the crowd, I think you increase the risk of permanent losses. So that was the key thing. I wanted to invest the way I believe made sense. And I was ready to wait for the results and the rewards to come later, and was able to wait for many, many years. And that was okay. Of course, I don't have regrets, but it was not that painful. I was ready to suffer for a while for better rewards in the future.
Being faithful to the mentality of a long-term investor.
And, you know, I was very lucky because Warren Buffett was such an inspiration. From the start of Giverny, I went to the Omaha annual meeting every year. And every year it was a time to go back to the roots of what I was doing. And Buffett and Munger were big inspiration. And sometimes I would, you know, just human nature, sometimes I would be a little discouraged or disappointed. But, you know, I got some validation that I was on the right path because I was following those great investors. And I think that's the greatest quality of both Warren and Charlie. They're very patient and they're very rational. And if they're on the right path, the right track, they'll just stick to their guns and be patient and wait for things to the fruit will be, there'll be rewards at some point in the future. And that's probably the big lesson that I've got from Berkshire Hathaway. Yes. And I still go over here today, so.
I think I read an article the other day that Berkshire has just started investing in some Japanese conglomerates, and they actually waited like 20 years until they were at a point where they felt comfortable buying. And you have to think about the 20 years, but then also that Buffett is making these investments when he's already 90 years old. So he's 90 years old and he's still thinking 20, 30 years out and being patient for 20 years. So I think that's just like a culmination of patience in any investor.
Yeah, I think Warren and Charlie, they're really people about principles. And by definition, a principle cannot be outdated because it wouldn't be a principle. And they have sound principles. And I think that, for me at least, I've learned a lot from them. And I owe them a lot also. So it was an inspiration for many years. And they are still an inspiration today. Yesterday, the meeting at the Daily Journal and the interview with Charlie was really interesting. I really love it. I mean, he's 99 years old, and I mean, those peanut brittle, you know, I should eat more of that.
Really? Yep.
It's wonderful. The results are incredible.
Yeah, and he's so sharp at that age.
I mean, these are really great mentors, and you can learn a lot just by reading and what they've said over many, many years. You can at least read all the Berkshire Hathaway annual letters, and goes back to, I think on the website, it's to 1977. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the best thing you can do with your time if you want to be a good investor.
So the last question is actually somewhat related. Do you have, what's your favorite investment book that maybe, it doesn't have to be, I know you talked about One Up on Wall Street, The Intelligent Investor. It doesn't have to be underrated, but if you know one book that maybe the people who are viewing or listening to this maybe don't know, and it has been a source of inspiration for you, what would that be?
I still think that the best book ever written on investing in the stock market is The Intelligent Investor. I think everything is in there. And there's three or four different versions from 1949 to, I think the last version is 1972, but they're all interesting. Perhaps a book not as well known would be the second book of Philip Fisher. It was called Path to Wealth Through Common Stocks. And I think that's a very, very good book. It was really, I think it was written in the 1960s, so it applies to another era, but lots of great lesson. I really love that book. I've read it many times. For many years, it was hard to find, but it's been republished recently, so you can find it.
Okay, perfect. Then I'll definitely buy it, because I have not read it. I have read, I think, the one that everyone has read from Phil Fisher, that is Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits.
Which is a very good book. But it's worth reading it.
Perfect. So that was the end of the questions that I had prepared. So thank you very much, Francois, because it was a great conversation. And I'm actually honored that you took the time to be here and come chat with me. And I think that a lot of people will benefit from this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.